This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Pixar Studios' Toy Story 3 is up for 5 Oscars this year, including an Academy Award nomination for Best Picture, only the 3rd time an animated film has been nominated in that category. And it's the highest-grossing animated film of all time, earning more than $1 billion worldwide. We're revisiting an interview Terry Gross conducted with the film's director, Lee Unkrich, and its screenwriter, Michael Arndt, last fall. Lee Unkrich has been with Pixar since 1994. He started there as a film editor on Toy Story and went on to co-direct Toy Story 2 and Monsters, Inc. Michael Arndt won an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for his first film, Little Miss Sunshine. At the beginning of Toy Story 3, Andy is preparing to leave home for college. His mother tells him that before he goes, he has to deal with his toys. She gives him several options. He can take them to college, store them in the attic, donate them to a daycare center, or put them in the trash. The toys are terrified that after years of being played with by Andy, after years of being cared for and loved, after years of being a little toy community, they will be abandoned and tossed on a garbage truck. Woody, the wooden toy sheriff voiced by Tom Hanks, tries to reassure the toys as the toys begin to panic.
We're getting thrown away?
No one's getting thrown away.
How do you know?
We're being abandoned.
We'll be fine, Jesse.
So why does Sarge leave?
Should we leave?
I thought we were going to the end.
Oh, I hate all this uncertainty.
Whoa, hold on. Now, wait a minute. Quiet. No one's getting thrown out, okay? We're all still here. I mean, yeah, we've lost friends along the way. Wheezy and Etch and...
Bo Peep?
Yeah, even Bo. All good toys who've gone on to new owners. But through every yard sale, every spring cleaning, Andy held on to us. He must care about us or we wouldn't be here.
You wait. Andy's gonna tuck us in the attic. It'll be safe and warm.
And we'll all be together.
Exactly. There's games up there and books and...
The race car track.
The race car track, thank you.
And the old TV.
There you go, the old TV. And those guys from the Christmas decorations box, they're fun, right?
Yeah.
And someday, if we're lucky, Andy may have kids of his own.
And he'll play with us then, right?
We'll always be there for him.
Come on, guys. Let's get our parts together, get ready, and go out on a high note.
It's a scene from Toy Story 3, and my guests are the director of the film, Lee Unkrich, and the writer, Michael Arndt. Welcome to Fresh Air. Although that scene is, you know, the toys worrying about being obsolete, I think it speaks to adults, because I think probably a lot of parents worry about becoming irrelevant in the lives of their children after their children grow up. Older adults in the workforce worry about being replaced by younger workers. You know, a lot of older people worry about becoming obsolete in their own way. And so I'm wondering, Michael Arndt, writing the film, if you were trying to operate on two levels at the same time, speaking to emotional fears that adults have and that children have.
It's funny, when you first start writing these films, usually what you're trying to do, I mean, you just sort of have a bag full of disparate ideas and none of them quite fit together. And so your first concern when you take this over is you're just trying to make everything fit together on a basic narrative level. And the scene that you just played, which we called Growing Up, when we started writing it, was one of the hardest scenes to write because you're meeting these characters sort of again for the first time and you have to figure out what their expectations for the future are. And I remember when we first started writing it, our thought was that, well, you know, Buzz is going to be an optimist and he's going to hope that they go to college with Andy, and Mr. Potato Head is going to be a pessimist and he's going to think that they're all going to get thrown out. And, you know, some other people think, well, maybe we'll go to the attic, and Woody, you know, is mature enough to say, well, I don't know what's going to happen. And the problem with that scenario, that setup, is that you end up having these endless conversations in which all the toys stand around and argue with what's about to happen. And I think I went back and counted all the drafts that we did of this scene. We did 60 different drafts. And the big breakthrough was finally deciding, okay, they all have already had this conversation before. They all have decided that they're going to get put in the attic. This is what happens to toys. This is part of the natural lifespan of toys, is that you serve you know, your kid, you play with your kid, and then if you do a good job, you're going to get, you know, sort of rewarded with retirement and put in the attic. And it was really only after we had set up that sort of narrative structure that we started to realize how emotional it was and how much it played into people's fears of obsolescence. And I do think that it speaks to people's, not everybody, but certainly a lot of people go through life feeling as though the work they do, the job they do at work or at home with their kids is unappreciated or unacknowledged. You know, these toys feel like they've given themselves over to this child, Andy, 100%, and played with him and shared so much of his life, and now he's going away. And they don't want to go with him necessarily to college. What they really want is acknowledgement.
I think that's why part of why people feel so much emotion in that last scene is that we've created a moment where the toys are appreciated, they are loved against all odds, and they are able to have that glorious feeling one last time. And I think it speaks to something deeply in a lot of people in the audience at different points in their lives.
Michael, your first film was the screenplay for Little Miss Sunshine, and since then you've been writing for animated characters. Was it hard for you to start thinking about the interior life of toys? Like, how would a dinosaur toy react? How would Mr. Potato Head react to a transition in his life?
You have to, as a writer, you can't make any difference have any distinction in your head between a live action character and an animated character. They're all real characters. I mean, to me, I feel like Buzz Lightyear is just as real as Olive Hoover is. You want to be sort of as emotionally honest and intelligent about what they're going through as you can possibly be. But it does lead to these sort of odd situations when you're a writer and suddenly you have to think, okay, I'm a little rag doll and I've just been put into a knapsack. You know, now what do I do? Or you know, I'm Mr. Potato Head and I lose my parts. How do I feel about that? So there were times when I thought it kind of felt odd to be writing scenes like that, but you have to take it seriously. Like, you have to put yourself in that position and say, okay, what would I do if I was in that situation? And there's times you almost feel ridiculous doing that. But I think once you make that commitment, and you write the characters sort of as honestly and with as much feeling as you can, people respond to that. People feel it coming through the screen.
So the toys in Toy Story 3 end up at a daycare center. And the preschool turns into a prison for Andy's toys, and then the movie becomes like a prison escape movie. So did you sit down and watch a lot of prison films?
Yeah, we did. I mean, Michael can attest to the fact that we spent many a day watching prison escape movies all day long, every day, to the point where we felt sometimes like we were trying to break out of prison ourselves.
The one thing we learned is that there's no such thing as a short prison movie. Basically, they're all more than 2 hours long. You know, but the shortest is 2 hours long.
Yeah, we saw one French film in particular. I don't know if you remember the name of it, Michael, where they literally the entire movie you watch them chip away at concrete, and then in the final minutes of the film they get busted, and then the movie ended.
Oh, that's the perfect stereotype of a certain type of really boring prison film, where they steal the spoon from the dining room and then slowly carve away at the wall. Yeah,
exactly. And we wanted to do all that stuff. I mean, I wish we could have done more. The actual prison break section of the movie ends up being just like 20 minutes of the film. But my story artist came up with so many great gag ideas. We had one idea where they were kind of digging their way out and Mr. Potato Head would secret the dirt away inside his butt and then kind of walk over to the corner and open his butt and dump the dirt out. And I mean, it's just like we wanted to have as many of these kind of great little prison cliches as possible. That's where the character of the chatter telephone came from, the Fisher-Price chatter telephone. Every one of these prison movies has some old guy who's been in there for life, and he totally knows the lay of the land, and he knows his way around, and somehow travels under the radar. And we knew we had to have a character like that, and we made this decision to have it be that Fisher-Price chatter telephone that we all either had when we were kids or knew somebody who had. We thought it would be a perfect person to be that character.
And Michael, what did you get from watching all the Prison Break movies?
Well, I mean, this is the tragedy of screenwriting, is that you always have like 1,000 ideas, basically, and then you have room for maybe 8 of them to go in the final film. I mean, we had a whole sequence. You know, in a lot of prison films, you show the preparations that everyone does for escape. Like, you show them stealing stuff, and you show them, you know, laying away stuff. And we actually had a whole sequence like that in the film. We had a whole sequence where they go steal the bag of marbles and they go steal the tortilla and they go, you know, get everything ready and prepared. And then we just ended up cutting that whole scene out because it just slowed the film down. It didn't really lead anywhere.
And it was kind of more fun to watch them kind of – to watch the plan unfold when we don't – you didn't even know what the plan was ourselves. But yeah, we – I mean, I wish I could have those all those hours of my life back that we banged our heads against the table trying to come up with ways for them to break out of prison.
Hey, Andy, let's get to work here. Anything you're not taking to college either goes in the attic or it's trash.
Mom, I'm not leaving till Friday.
Come on, it's garbage day.
Mom.
Look, it's simple. Skateboard, college. Little League trophy, probably attic. Apple core, trash. You can do the rest.
Why do you still have these toys?
Molly, out of my room.
Three more days and it's mine.
Molly, you're not off the hook either. You have more toys than you know what to do with. Some of them could make other kids really happy.
What kids?
The children at the daycare. They're always asking for donations.
What's daycare?
Shh,
no buts. You choose the toys you want to donate. I'll drop them off at Sunnyside.
Poor Barbie.
I get the Corvette.
Andy, come on. You need to start making decisions.
Like what?
Like, what are you going to do with these toys? Should we donate them to Sunnyside?
No.
Maybe sell them online?
Mom, no one's going to want those old toys. They're junk.
Fine. You have till Friday. Anything that's not packed for college or in the attic is getting thrown out.
Whatever you say, Mom.
Lee, you have a story from your own life about accidentally throwing out toys. Would you tell that story?
Years ago, my wife, Laura, and I were moving from one apartment to another and packing everything up. And about a month after we moved to our new place, Laura asked me if I'd seen her beloved stuffed animals, her childhood stuffed animals. And I said, what box were they in? And she said, well, they weren't in a box. They were in a garbage bag. And my blood instantly ran ice cold because I realized exactly what had happened. I had thrown all of her stuffed animals away in the dumpster behind our building. So I feel terrible to this day that that happened. But I do hope that by immortalizing that moment in the movie that that they somehow have been immortalized themselves.
So did you come up with the premise of Toy Story 3 because of this story that we just heard, Lee, of you accidentally throwing out your wife's stuffed animals?
No, that kind of came later. I mean, truly, the very beginning of this was, you know, we had wanted to make a Toy Story 3 for years, ever since Toy Story 2. And unfortunately, there were a bunch of kind of boring contractual problems between Disney and Pixar at the time that prevented us from making a Toy Story 3. And that went on for years. And then finally, just over 4 years ago, Disney bought Pixar Animation Studios. We became a part of Disney, and those problems went away, and we were finally freed up to make a Toy Story 3. So at that point, John Lasseter asked me to direct the film, and we then subsequently went off on a retreat. John and Andrew Stanton, who I know you've spoken to, and Pete Docter, and we talked long and hard about what we wanted Toy Story 3 to be. And we're all in agreement right from the beginning that we didn't want Toy Story 3 to feel like an arbitrary grafted-on sequel. You know, I always had in my mind the movie The Bad News Bears Go to Japan as a model of what we didn't want to do. We didn't want to make the film unless we felt like we really had something to say. And ultimately, the most important thing for us was that we wanted to treat this third film like kind of the completion of a saga, like as if we had been telling one grand story over the course of the three films. So we looked at it in that way, and what we arrived at pretty quickly was that it was vital to have Andy grown up and be at that transition where the toys were on the cusp of no longer being needed or wanted or loved, and that just seemed like the perfect setting for the story.
So are there ways that you started to examine the world differently, knowing that you were writing from the point of view of toys? And, you know, that you were not only writing from the point of view of a child, but from, like, stuffed animals and, you know, a wooden cowboy and a plastic Tyrannosaurus Rex. Mike, let me ask you, because you're newer to this.
When we are in a story meeting, we're trying to figure this stuff out. We usually go to the human analog. Like, we usually, we don't talk about Well, if I were a rag doll, or well, if I were a plastic dinosaur, we start talking about you because you want to get to the emotional truth of this story. And you want to get to the emotional truth of these characters. And so you go, okay, well, Woody is, he's a little bit like a helicopter mom. He's a little bit like a mom who can't let go of her child, And so we always try and figure out, what is the human equivalent of one of these characters.
But then the fun thing is once we have that figured out, we then try to find ways of making their issues particularly a toy's issues. I mean, Ken was a great instance of,
this is Ken as in Ken and Barbie, yeah.
Exactly. Ken of Ken and Barbie. Michael, I don't know if you had any Ken dolls when you were growing up. I certainly didn't, but my friend's little sisters did, and we made endless fun of Ken. I mean, Ken is just a whipping boy. And
in the movie, I should say, his masculinity is always being called into question.
Well, I don't know if his masculinity to some degree, but it's more that, we thought, well, what does it feel like to be a guy who's a girl's toy? You're a guy, but you're only played with by little girls. And then further, he's just an accessory to Barbie. He doesn't carry equal weight with Barbie. He's really no more important than a pair of shoes or a belt or a purse to her. And we knew that he would have to have a complex.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things that's such a pleasure working on a film like this is that you go, okay, well, what are going to be the issues of a character like Ken? Like, what's going to be the thing that, like, keeps him awake at night, And, immediately you come into the fact that, well, maybe he's a little bit insecure about the fact that really he's a girl's toy, and maybe he's in denial of that. And then you suddenly this whole sort of richness opens up. And the fact that, what do Ken and Barbie do? All they do is, they sort of have their accessories and they have their clothes. So when they meet for the first time, I had to think as a writer, okay, well, what are they going to say to each other? Like, what is the thing that they're going to have in common? And it's of course, it's just the fact that they have all these different clothes. And so you have to think, well, these characters probably love clothes and they remember all the different collections from all the different years. And so, when they first meet, the first thing is, he compliments her on her her leg warmers, and she compliments him on his ascot, and you realize, oh my God, these were made for each other. And then when they sort of break up at the end, and they are at odds with each other, what's the one thing that Barbie can do to sort of torture Ken and get some information out of him? She's going to, attack his wardrobe and start ripping them to pieces.
A lot of people report having cried at the end of Toy Story 3, and Michael, when you were writing the film, were you thinking, yeah, they'll really be tearing up at this scene? Were you thinking about that at all?
You don't think that at all. You just think, oh my God, I hope this works. I hope people like this. But I remember when I wrote the first draft, I wrote it in sequence. I wrote it chronologically. So I started off, with scene one and then scene two, and it took me about 6 weeks. Maybe 6 to 8 weeks to write the first draft. And I remember, so I felt like as I was writing the story, I was experiencing it with these characters. And you see them go through all these travails and, these betrayals and all these terrible things happen to them. And through the whole story, Woody keeps insisting, no, Andy still cares about us. I know he does. It doesn't seem that way, but I know he still cares about us. And I remember getting to going to my office, sitting down to write the final scene. And I say, okay, I have to figure out what Andy's going to say when he hands over Woody. And I, these words, I just start hearing Andy's voice saying, Woody's brave like a cowboy should be and kind and smart, but the thing that makes him special is that he'll never give up on you. And as I was writing this, like, I couldn't help but just get all choked up, and I, had little tears coming down my eyes because I felt like I had been on that journey with those characters, That's when you know that a script is working, when you have that response as you're writing it. So, I remember just finishing the scene, and there was kind of an odd moment where I finished it, and then I sort of walked out, of the door of my office to take a break, and everybody was just sort of going about their business as though nothing had happened. And in my own mind, there had been this huge, huge thing that had happened, that Andy had given away Woody, I was just I felt a little silly, but I felt like you'd hit the target that you'd set up for yourself. So it's just very gratifying to see that other people end up experiencing that scene the same way.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Terry. It was great to be here.
Toy Story 3 director Lee Unkrich and screenwriter Michael Arndt speaking to Terry Gross last year. Their movie is up for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, and it's the highest-grossing film in that category.